So welcome everybody to part two of the Path of the Bodhisattva, Choosing a Life of Kindness. I was paying attention to our conversation just now about right view and what does it mean to live within our conditioning, and unless we had Buddhist saints for parents, we're probably all living our lives through our conditioning. And I was having a conversation with a friend the other day I hadn't seen in a while. And we were just having one of those catch-up conversations in which both of us shared good stuff that was going on and maybe also a little bit of annoyance. You know, just this sort of the typical, this is what life is. And she said, really, you have that? You're my mindfulness friend. I said, you know, awareness is one thing, but I'm not a saint. So I appreciate that you just said that about, you know, our conditioning is huge. It's the lens through which we see things. It's how we relate. And we have a lot of agency within this beautiful practice of cultivating awareness and kindness and wisdom. And I think it is the path of the Bodhisattva to choose a life of kindness. So last week we talked about that, and I want to keep going on this topic. In essence, you know, when we define what is a Bodhisattva, it's anybody who works for the good of everybody else, but everybody else doesn't leave out ourselves. It really is dedicating ourselves to a life of being helpful, of being willing to be with whatever is happening, to meet suffering with this courageous heart. And I think that it is, as I work with it and understand my own relationship to what is a Bodhisattva and how do I show up as a Bodhisattva, and all of us, how we really, as practitioners, as anybody who really wants to develop this mind and heart and ease our own suffering so we can help to suffer, ease the suffering of others, or when we are in reciprocal relationship and somebody helps us that eases our suffering, this is the life of the Bodhisattva. But I think it is, for me, more and more a deeper and deeper understanding of our interconnection. Because it is really true that by caring for myself, I'm caring for others, and by caring for others, I'm caring for myself. The Buddha said that very specifically. By protecting myself, I protect others, and vice versa. So we can think about the various Bodhisattva vows, in certainly in Zen tradition, that says, creations are numberless, I vow to save them all, which feels so abstract, so impossible. And my very favorite way of relating to a Bodhisattva vow is this. I heard Frank Ostoseski say this one time: the world is suffering and it's my job to meet it. It's so simple. I know it's not easy to do this. I don't mean that. I mean the definition of a Bodhisattva. The world is suffering, and we know that. And it's our job to meet it. And I think that defining Bodhisattva in that way removes the fantasy that we can solve it, but we can meet it. Once we've done our own work, or continuing to do our own practices of meeting our own suffering, understanding all the different ways in which difficulty arises and how we meet it, when do we tend to make things worse, and when do we say, okay, this is difficult, but I can meet it? That's when I think things open up for us, when we're not in contention anymore, when we have more capacity to meet our own suffering and the suffering of others. Thich Nhat Hanh said, as I was listening to him teach on the Anapanasati Sutta, mindfulness of breathing, and he was talking about, on an in-breath, I know I may have a difficult emotion. There may be pain here. On an out-breath, I will not do violence to my pain. That's what he said. And it was so beautiful because what he was saying is, I can meet my suffering with this kind heart. And he said, and of course, we're all going to have this. And he said, so because we're all going to have it, make good use of the mud. Make good use of the mud, which I love, because it doesn't, because we all have mud. And mud literally is full of nutrients. Oftentimes, mud is really a good source of growth. So another question that we can ask as we're meeting our own suffering and others' suffering is not so much, where is this all coming from? Which is a natural thing. We want to figure out, where is this suffering coming from, so maybe we can do something about it to understand it more deeply. But I find over and over again that the question, instead of where is this coming from, I find that what is more helpful to me is, where is this suffering leading? Where is this suffering leading? Which I think is akin to make good use of the mud. Or, and sometimes you might hear the phrase, what is onward leading? What is onward leading in the practice? And this is talking about wisdom. To make good use of the mud, what are we learning here? What is the wisdom that is getting cultivated that we can draw on? Where is the suffering leading? There's wisdom in that question, because then we're not stuck so much. So the bodhisattva is the one who commits to, in Jewish tradition, to tikkun olam, healing the world, right? This world is broken. How can we be of assistance? So I also talked last week about this book that I've been very interested in from the scholar Peter Skilling called Questioning the Buddha. It's a selection of 25 suttas, and there's a sutta in there about the bodhisattva that says the four teachings that bodhisattvas should practice as long as they live. This is worth repeating. Bodhisattvas should cultivate an aspiration for awakening as long as they live. Should maintain spiritual friendships as long as they live. Should practice patience, openness, and kindness as long as we live. And spend some portion of time dwelling in the wilderness as long as we live. So these four teachings have impacted me in a really deep way since I came across this a while ago, and I find myself coming back over and over again to, what does it mean to make these commitments to awakening, to Kalyanamitta, to patience, openness, and kindness, and dwelling in the wilderness for periods of time. So tonight I want to talk a little bit more about the third one of these, that we are tasked with practicing patience and openness and kindness. And where I went to with this, I was reading about Zen peacemakers. Anybody familiar with Zen peacemakers? Really, really wonderful organization that was started in, I think, 1994 from Roshi Bernie Glassman. And Bernie Glassman was a giant of a figure, a Zen teacher. He was the teacher of Roshi Joan Halifax, and he was the one who started what are known as bearing witness retreats, started out in the East Coast doing city retreats, go live in the streets with people who are living in the streets and really bear witness, really be present in that way. And that expanded to doing bearing witness retreats at Auschwitz and Birkenau. To spend long periods of time really being in that kind of suffering, really cultivating this bodhisattva vow to stick with it. So the three tenets of Zen peacemakers are these. The first is not knowing, the second, bear witness, and then the third, take action. So I want to talk about these three tenets and how it relates to our practice. So to show up not knowing, We're asked to do that all the time, aren't we? And this goes back to our conditioning. Can we not know? And Suzuki Roshi, you know, who taught us so much about beginner's mind. In the beginner's mind are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few. So what if we show up not knowing, letting go of fixed ideas about ourselves, about others, about the world, about our communities? This is pretty challenging because we see the world through our own eyes, through our own experiences. And it brings us right up into exploring our own core limiting beliefs. So core limiting beliefs, beliefs that are core, things that are fundamental to who we are, but that might limit our capacity to consider what else is true, to consider that more than one thing can be true at any given time. But we're very loyal to our views. We're very loyal to our opinions. So to let go of fixed ideas is challenging, really challenging. And it doesn't mean let go of your core values. But it does mean take a look at what are the tentacles of them, and then how does that influence other parts of one's thinking? Can we reframe a narrative? And this reframing is a very important part of not knowing, because we show up with whatever our views are, with whatever, to whatever the situation is that probably we care about. And we might have a certain narrative, but can we have a big enough perspective? And I think that this is actually one of the functions of open awareness meditation that helps us widen out. When we train in widening out the awareness in meditation to let thoughts come, energies come, emotions, all of it, let it happen without getting caught, or when we do get caught, noticing the caught and then opening up again. That is a training for showing up not knowing. Because as I would guess that those of us here, that we are lay practitioners, we're not monastics. And so as lay practitioners, when we're training in meditation, we may all have different intentions for why we are practicing meditation. But I think the meditation itself is a training to keep showing up in our lives, in our walking around daily lives. Not becoming, you know, probably none of us here spend 16 or 18 hours a day meditating, becoming professional breathers. I don't think that's what we're doing. So when we can reframe, when we can show up not knowing, all kinds of things can still be true, but we can ask ourselves, what else is true? And this is a very important question, to be able to say what else might be true. And interestingly, this comes from the work of Richie Davidson, who's at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, brain researcher, who's been studying the brains of monastics, who's the first one to work with the Dalai Lama doing that. There's a circuit in the brain that is dedicated to reframing that he has found. It's very interesting. That the ability to say what else is true, can I reframe this, has its own wiring. And that's how important it is that the brain is trained to expand the awareness. And you know, in the Buddha said it, by not holding to fixed views in the Metta Sutta, the pure-hearted one having clarity of vision is not born again into this world. We end suffering in that moment. Here's a short poem from Wendell Berry that points to that. It's called Our Real Work. It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we've come to our real work. And that when we no longer know which way to go, we've come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. Isn't that great? It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we've come to our real work. This is the not knowing. That when we no longer know which way to go, we've come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed, right? The fixed views. There's no baffle there because we just know. But the impeded stream is the one that sings. So not knowing. The second of these tenets, which might feel similar, is bearing witness. But in order to bear witness, to be with the joy and the suffering that is true in the world, we have to not know. We have to be willing to show up. And what Zen peacemakers say, this is how they define bearing witness. The practice of bearing witness is to see all of the aspects of a situation, including your attachments and judgments. When you bear witness, you open to the uniqueness of whatever is arising and meet it just as it is. And this can strengthen your capacity to listen to other points of view, allowing a more nuanced picture of a situation to emerge. And through this not knowing, through this showing up, this willingness to bear witness, when I have been able to do that, and I can't always do it, but it is a practice. When we really show up, I think that what happens is we experience the truth of the three marks of experience, the truth of dukkha, the truth of impermanence, the truth of interconnection, but we also experience greed and ill will and ignorance, these three poisons. What are the parts of us that we want what we want, we push away what we don't want, the conditioning that keeps us, exactly what Mary said, ignorant? But so when we really show up and we're just there, I think we can see clearly how these work, how greed, ill will, and delusion, they can take up residence in us. And what do we need to do to dismantle that, to disentangle from it? And we can see it in others. But our job isn't to tell others what to do about it. Our job is to show up and be there and engage in as skillful a way as possible. So in the Metta Sutta, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. And then, you know, the sutta goes on. I didn't bring the whole thing. But that first sentence is a prescription. This is what should be done. And the Buddha didn't say could be done. He's saying this is what you need to do by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. So we are training in goodness. We are training in peacemaking. And this last stanza, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, free of addiction to sense desires, is not born again into this world of suffering. This is how important it is to be in relationship with our fixed views. And my hunch is we all have them. It's part of the human condition. And another perspective on not knowing and bearing witness comes from the third Zen patriarch, Sangsan, in the Verses of the Faith Mind. This is might be a little, sometimes feels a little tricky for me to grasp this, but here's what he said. The great way, our practice, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. Can love, can hate be both absent? You know, that my inclination is, well, yes, of course I want to not have any hate, any ill will in my heart, but I want love. And I think what he's pointing to here by saying absent is that it's the greed and the ill will that what we're, we don't have this strong push-pull, but we can actually be here with what is. And it goes on to say, if you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you don't like is the disease of the mind, right? This is the separation. To set up what you like against what you don't like is the disease of the mind. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. So this is our whole practice. This is so rich. And then it goes on to say, to live in this realization, the realization that the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences, is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. Now, isn't that fabulous? To be without anxiety about non-perfection. This is hard. We're not going to always get it right. But we can keep showing up, not knowing, bear witness. And there are these are little lines from the faith verses that I've pulled out that are poignant to me. Stop talking and thinking, and there's nothing you will not be able to know. Isn't that great? Stop talking and thinking, and there is nothing you will not be able to know. This is when this mind settles, right? This is the third noble truth. Peace is possible. There's an end of suffering when the mind is in abeyance. Wisdom arises. That's where there's that opening. Only cease to cherish opinions. Only cease to cherish opinions. And from the Buddha, those who cling to their views go about the world annoying others. Those who cling to their views go about the world annoying others. So not knowing, bearing witness, really studying our core limiting beliefs, the ways we are loyal to them, what can we open up to? Can we trust? Can we take a little risk to say what else might be happening here? And the third tenet from Zen Peacemakers is take action, take caring action that arises from not knowing, that arises from bearing witness. And the way they talk about it is this: it's impossible to predict what the action of any situation might be, or the situation will be, or the timetable for when it will arise or what might result from it. The underlying intention is that the action that arises be a caring action, which serves everyone and everything, including yourself and the whole situation. That is, the world is suffering, it's my job to meet it. How can we build something together, the tikkun olam, the repairing of the world, which includes us? And, you know, it occurs to me that, you know, there are situations I've been in that have been difficult. And by showing up and working with others and myself, sometimes there's an outcome I never expected, that none of us have ever expected, that's really for the benefit of everybody, by being willing to not know, by being willing to open, to be curious, to be kind, to be patient. And it's not easy. And we can't do it all ourselves. And we're not each responsible for it. But we can't stop working. Third century Rabbi Tarfon said, "It's not upon you to finish the work, nor are you free to desist from it." Right? It's not upon you to finish the work, but you're not free to avoid it. That's being a bodhisattva. And also, I think that this taking caring action, not knowing what might happen, can take us into a long conversation about the difference between attachment and commitment. That we make a commitment, and we may have talked about this last week, we keep going in a direction, but not contingent on only if it works the way we want it to work. right? That doesn't work. Like, I'll only get involved with this thing if I know that it's going to come out the way I want it to. That's not what we're doing. We commit to wise action, to caring action, because it's the right thing to do. But we don't have to know what the outcome is going to be. We can't actually know what the outcome is going to be. There's a Zen priest in Oregon. His name is Hogan Bays, who's married to Jan Chosen Bays, another Zen priest. And this is an excerpt from a poem he wrote. It's called, "I Vow to Choose What Is. If there is cost, I choose to pay. If there is need, I choose to give. If there is pain, I choose to feel. If there's sorrow, I choose to grieve. When burning, I choose heat. When calm, I choose peace. When starving, I choose hunger. When happy, I choose joy. Whom I encounter, I choose to meet. What I shoulder, I choose to bear. When it is my death, I choose to die. Where this takes me, I choose to go. Being with what is, I respond to what is." That's our practice, to see clearly enough, to be with what is, to respond appropriately to what is. Joanna Macy, in her book Active Hope, in discussions of the Bodhisattva and vows and commitments and exactly what we're talking about, this is what she created for her own Bodhisattva vow. She says, "I vow to myself and each of you to commit myself daily to the healing of our world and the welfare of all beings, to live on the earth more lightly and less violently in the food, products, and energy I consume, to draw strength and guidance from the living earth, the ancestors, the future generations, and my brothers and sisters of all species, to support others in our work for the world, and to ask for help when I need it, to ask for help when I need it, to pursue a daily practice that clarifies my mind, strengthens my heart, and supports me in observing these vows." Those are beautiful, aren't they? To live on the earth more lightly, less violently, to commit to helping myself and others live on this planet more than the human world. I was listening to Rebecca Solnit recently. Rebecca Solnit is a brilliant thinker. Anybody familiar with Rebecca? She's, you know her, Liz. She's written many, many books. And I was listening to an interview with James Shaheen. James Shaheen is the editor of Tricycle magazine. And they do regular interviews of interesting Buddhist thinkers, teachers. And he was interviewing Rebecca Solnit, and she was talking about climate issues, but basically she was talking about, what does it mean to be a bodhisattva? How do we actually show up? And she was reflecting on Katrina, just a long time ago now, when that happened, and how many thousands of people were stranded, and how many thousands of people also were helping. And that there was such an enormous need. There was no way to meet the need entirely. But this is what she said about how we show up. She said, "Get your boat in the water. You're not going to rescue everybody, but it's not your job to do it all by yourself. And rescuing somebody is deeply meaningful, even if you can't rescue everybody. Nobody rescued everybody, but a lot of people rescued somebody. So get your boat in the water." All right, this is what we're doing here. We have to take our practice off of our cushion and get the boat in the water. Show up not knowing, be willing to bear witness, be willing to take caring action. Know when you need to rest. Caring action is knowing when you need to rest. Nobody rescued everybody, and a lot of people rescued somebody. So thank you for listening. And let's have a little time to talk with each other. Anybody at all, feel free to unmute.
Thank you for putting your boat in the water.
You're welcome. Liz, please.
Hi, thanks for a wonderful talk, really wonderful talk.
My pleasure.
You quoted one of my favorite poems by Wendell Berry. I've never really quite understood that last line. I use this poem a lot in my teaching. The impeded stream is the one that sings. That is a mystery to me, but you might want to say more about it.
Okay, so let's do that. So imagine a stream or a river that has no boulders in it, has no rapids in it. It's this very peaceful, quiet, moving river. And it's so still, and it just goes. It just goes, no issues at all. It just goes. No problems, no obstacles, no opportunity. Well, I'd be careful about that. It's easy to get complacent. I think this is where we're going. Mm-hmm. It's easy to get complacent when things are just floating along. It's pretty, just, you know, we just go along with it. But if we take this metaphor literally and imagine boulders and rapids and weather and things that are obstacles to the flow of things, that's when you have to learn what you're going to do about it. When things are easy, it's easy. You know, and that's when we can very easily fall into default habit patterns. We just think, oh yeah, everything is fine. We're just going along. But as soon as there's an obstacle, we have to figure out what to do. And so the impeded stream is the one that can learn more. We can keep learning. We're going to have to find solutions to whatever is going on. That's how I relate to this poem.
Thank you. And just a couple of more things I wanted to say. I've been quite ill for the last couple of years, and I'm quite old. And all of a sudden, I started to say the Bodhisattva vow.
Oh, wow. Wow.
I've been thinking of what I want to take with me. And I took the Bodhisattva vow 20 years ago with Pema Chodron. But I don't, you know, I also want to say one thing that you know very well. We're on a journey. None of this changes tomorrow night. This is a long and important journey that we're committed to. Yeah. And I love the Bodhisattva vow. And I guess I'm taking it with me into the next life. And it just popped up out of the blue. I was quite surprised by it. And then I just read something that I wanted to read to you, and I think you'll like. I don't really know who said it, but the way you alchemize a soulless world into a sacred world is by treating everyone as if they are sacred until the sacred in them remembers.
That's beautiful. Thank you, Liz. I want to recognize that I think when a vow or a practice, whatever it is that arises, and you know you need to meet it, you do.
Good point. As Philip says, as best one is able.
As best one is able. Thank you, Liz. Thank you. Patty and then Deborah. Hey, Patty.
Hey, thank you so much for that beautiful talk.
My pleasure.
I realize when I hear you talk that it's an example of everything being connected, because everything you say makes so much sense, and I'm reminded of everything other teachers have said, and it all meshes together. I'll give two examples. 2 weeks ago, Matthew Brensilver did a retreat with us, and he talked about there's an inherent violence in a fixed view. And there's an inherent nonviolence, a little element of violence in a fixed view. And there's an element of nonviolence in an open mind. And every time you talked about the not knowing mind, I thought, well, that's the path of peace.
That's right. That's
and
exactly
I'm
right.
okay. The other thing that it reminded me of is I was recently in a skilled nursing facility for 3 weeks recovering from a broken femur.
Oh no. Oh, Patty.
And I'm much better now. I'm taking steps. This week is the first time I can walk without my walker or rollator. I'm walking with just sticks and
wow.
I'm getting better. I'm getting better. I can live without ibuprofen now. So I'm on the mend. But while I was in that facility, I decided to treat it sort of like a meta retreat. And I sent everybody all day, meta, everyone that came in the room, everyone I worked with, everyone I saw. And the one thing that helped me a lot, because the food was adequate. That's the kindest thing I can say about it. But I practiced no preference, no problem. And whatever they brought me, I was grateful for because I didn't have to cook it. I didn't have to clean up after it. And it was adequate. It was nourishing. It wasn't spirit rock fabulous. It was adequate. But having no preference made it such a delightful experience. I'm the only one in there who didn't groan every time a meal showed up. So a lot of what you talk about just is coming together with all the other teachings I've practiced and heard lately. And I just love how the Dharma is just so accurate and so appropriate in every circumstance. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Patty. I mean, that was a beautiful Dharma talk you just gave us. So here's the thing that I love that you know that you're experiencing. You can pull one little string of the Dharma and start seeing how it's connected to everything else. And one of the things about this practice that I find so exciting is the way we can connect the dots. It is Indra's net. It is completely connected and it makes sense. And also, I'm so glad that you're feeling better. And good for you for practicing metta in the skilled nursing facility and being able to see what was good enough, really what was good enough. Thank you. Deborah and then Rebecca.
So first of all, I love you, Patty. Thank you for that. And same goes to you and for you, Heidi Born.
Thank you, Deborah.
For that. And I love that you bring up the Zen teachings because I mentioned already, I started off at Green Gulch for 7 years, intensely involved, and I forget some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really perfect. So I'm so grateful, and I'm going to re-listen to this talk so I can write them down and post them. I have things posted all over the place. And I also wanted to tell you that I ordered two of Jan Chosen Bay's books.
Oh, great. Good.
After your talk last week, the one that you mentioned, and also Training Your Elephant.
I love that book.
I need very simple. My bandwidth is narrow in my brain these days, so I need very simple, and I'm looking forward to them arriving soon.
Good. I'm so glad you did that. They're
Thank
great.
You.
They're
Thank
both
you.
Great.
And this talk was fabulous. The not having to rescue everybody really resonated because I have been trying hard to help a neighbor of mine who's 95 and having a lot of problems. And I've been working diligently and making medical appointments and that sort of thing to find out that some other people that I did not know about have been working in the exact, totally under, and I had to really watch my reactivity to that.
I bet.
And thinking, why wasn't I in this loop? And why? But I understand this woman is not a very good communicator and she has a lot of hearing impairment. So your talk was cogent, so deliciously cogent. So thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Rebecca, hi.
Heidi, hi. I just need help in terms of no preference. The social activism shouldn't exist. You know where I'm going, Heidi.
Yeah.
Social activism shouldn't exist. Nonviolence shouldn't exist. Preference for non-harm shouldn't exist. Say more about not having preference. I have a lot of trouble understanding that.
I have a lot of trouble understanding it too, which is why I keep bringing it in, because I think this is pointing to a middle way. This is pointing to not having polarities, to not having to have things be on the extremes. This is how I understand it. I don't know if I'm right, Rebecca, but this is something we can really chew on together. So let me just read that again. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. That does not mean don't care. That's how I relate to this.
Mm-hmm.
Because equanimity doesn't mean we're, I'm losing the word. Distant isn't the word, but we care. It is not about not caring. Mm-hmm. It's not really about whatever. It isn't that. But if we hold any view so tightly that we can't see what else is going on, even if it's a view of love or whatever we're committed to that is wholesome and skillful, we need the ability to widen out to be able to listen to other views. And it doesn't, I don't think this means don't commit yourself to nonviolence. Don't commit yourself to these skillful, wholesome things. I think it means to also be able to be realistic about what else is happening. I think this is really, really hard. And let's also understand the context that this is a translation and it's ancient. And maybe it's not all in context to what we're talking about now, because we're living in a world that is different from when this was written. But I think what it does open up is, again, that place of having a wide enough view that we can understand that people come to whatever we've got, whatever is going on, with myriad experiences, that the causes and conditions that are present for anything to be happening are so vast, and that my conditioning and your conditioning and everybody's conditioning that is here is different. But it doesn't mean don't be committed to all of the ways that non-harming can show up, that we need. But also keep a wide view. Is that at all helpful?
I can listen to views of, you know, in prison, I can listen to views of violence. But once the inmates know that there's an alternative to violence, then I can listen to it, but it doesn't go anywhere. What goes somewhere is for the guys to know that there is a way other than violence.
Of course. Do you do work in prisons?
Yeah.
So that's wonderful. I mean, good for you. It's not just, I mean, we could talk about this for a long time, and it's really a valuable.
I know.
It's a really important.
It's not about not listening. It's about offering a new alternative.
Correct. Right. Because that would, that's what the taking caring action means. Out of the listening, out of the not knowing, out of the bearing witness, that then something else can arise to say to incarcerated people, you know, there's something else for you to consider. And so the commitment to offering something else that could really be helpful is a wise action. And then for yourself, are you attached to whether or not somebody takes you up on it? Or can you keep doing the work? Because
it's not to have a preference for nonviolence, but how tightly are you holding it? That's the key.
This is what we're talking about. How tightly are you holding it?
The clarity of that needs to happen. Yeah.
Totally. And we do this together. I mean,
it's not to have a preference. It's how tight do you hold the preference, really?
I think that's right. And that's why we need to have a nuanced view of it.
A little bit tweaked.
Yeah. And we get to do that. We get to tweak it.
Get the word tweaked?
Yeah. I think that
we're right. All right.
I think we can do that because it's context. It's cultural context. And so we need to use our wisdom to say, okay, so third Zen patriarch, that was a really long time ago. It's patriarchy. I mean, it's all these things that I recognize I brought that in, but what I brought that in because we're talking about not knowing and bearing witness and finding that way to take caring action, but not holding anything too tightly. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, that's
really appreciate it.